But before we actually start talking about chapter 13, I should say that we are entering a very interesting phase of this book for several chapters. It's also a very controversial portion of this book, and interpretation of what's here depends a lot on the chronology that you buy into. But before we get into that discussion, there's some things that we need to talk about first that I think you need to know from a historical standpoint that will help to bring us to an understanding that the first century Christians had, who were the audience that John was writing to. One of them was, we all have heard the name Nero. Nero was one of the first emperors that considered himself to be someone that should be worshipped and considered himself to be the Son of God. Now, his interpretation of God was different than ours, of course, but nonetheless, that was the belief. Nero died in June 9th, AD 68, same year approximately that the Apostle Paul was martyred. And Paul was killed first, and then Nero died later in that same year. If it's 68, it could have been 69, but if it was 69, it wouldn't have been Nero that killed Paul, but all the writings seem to indicate that it was Nero. But Nero was the first emperor to sanction state-wide persecution of the Christians, to the extent that we know he burned many of them at the stake. He used a lot of them to set on fire and put on post and light his garden for his debaucherous parties that he would conduct. That all was done because he didn't admit to what most historians say, that he was the cause of Rome burning, and he blamed that on the Jews, and that's why on the Christians. And that's why he was persecuting the Christians. That went on after his death, but something that ties in with this book that you may not be aware of, that's kind of important, that sets the stage of what John is talking about, is that there was a tradition among the Romans, and it carried into the audience of the Christians of the first century. Many of the Christians, because of the type of person Nero was, when he died, did not believe that he actually died. The Romans, on the other hand, that knew he died, believed that that was temporary and he would be resurrected in the future. And that gave way to something that historians or theologians call the new Nero, because they held on to, while Rome was on a decline, they held on to the fact that Rome would get completely strong again, and it would be a reincarnation of Nero that would do that. Now, this went on for decades. They held on to this belief, and some of the Christians did too. They were convinced that Nero was still alive, especially because the persecutions got more intense. Titus, who was the second emperor out, and the father of Domitian, was every bit as much of a problem to the Christians as Nero was. And then Domitian did more executions than all of them put together. He was also the one that exiled John, at least by the chronology that I believe in, and Aaron has come to believe that also, that Domitian was the emperor whenever John was exiled. So he was the emperor when the book of Revelation was written. What's interesting about that is that this belief of the new Nero continued on into the next century, not just the first century. Rome was looking to this miraculous reincarnation of their emperor who was going to solve all of their problems and eliminate the Christians, which they felt was the cause of their problems, because that's what Nero said was the cause of their problem. Now, Titus and Domitian were also individuals who firmly believed that they should be worshipped. They were, quote unquote, the son of God. They believed they were the son of Zeus, which was their primary deity in their way of worship. And therefore, they believed that they should be worshipped. And unfortunately, some of the Christians of the first century, as I said, bought into the idea of... So, I should say it this way. Nero, then, the new Nero, became another way of saying the Antichrist. And so many of the first century Christians believed that Nero, but the new Nero, the reincarnated Nero, was going to be the Antichrist. What's interesting is, in Armenian, the term Nero means Antichrist in their language. So it was perpetuated throughout the Roman Empire, and they were all waiting for that. Something else that ties into the Romans' belief of an eternal existence of their empire was, early in the days of the foundation of their empire, they found buried in the ground a human head, and they took that as a prophecy that Rome was going to, in the future, be strong again, stronger than ever. Towards the end of the first century, Rome was on a decline. It continued to be on a decline. So they believed, in looking to the eternal aspect of Rome. So Christians in Rome, let's put it this way, citizens of Rome who became Christians, were influenced by this tradition in their culture. So when they were exposed to the book of Revelation, their view on it obviously would be different than ours, slightly, because they believed that some of the imagery here in chapter 13 and the next two chapters is actually talking about Rome. And you've heard traditionally Rome being put in that position. I believe that too, but I believe that there's more to it than just Rome. And certainly, I don't prescribe to the new Nero, although there is Antichrist that are mentioned here. The imagery that John uses, that he calls upon from things that the first century Christians would know, was something that would allow them to better understand what might be talking about. And just understand that a lot of this is not necessarily something that happens immediately. Just like some of the Old Testament prophecies, there was things that were going to happen in their time and things that were going to happen down the road in the future. So just keep all of that in mind when we go through and look at this, and remember that this vision that John talks about here of this multi-headed beast is similar to the vision that Daniel had in Daniel 7, also in Daniel 12. So you remember in Daniel 7 that when he fell into a trance, and what he saw was a beast that rose out of the water, and there was also one that was on the sand of the shore. Let's keep that in your mind now whenever we go and look at a few verses here in chapter 13. And I'm going to read from the King James Version tonight. So chapter 13 of Revelation, verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads, 10 horns, and on the horns 10 crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon we've been talking about in the last chapter, the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. Now remember some of the things that I talked to you about. There is very little question when you read the explanation given Daniel that what he saw represented kingdoms of the earth, empires. Some had passed, and some were yet to come, Rome certainly being one of those. Now, there had been many visions that Daniel saw concerning. One of them was the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had when he saw that statue with the different layers. And the last layer was one that wasn't destroyed until the time of Christ. And you only have to ask yourself, what was the great empire at the time of Christ? Rome. Rome. With very little question, that was Rome. Now, what I should do, I guess, is to tell you a couple other things. That I'm going to give you a list of the parallels between what we're talking about in the first 7 verses of Revelation and how they line up with which verses in Daniel 7. So 13:1 matches Daniel 7, 2 through 3, and verse 7. Revelation 13:2 lines up with Daniel 7, 3 through 6. 13:4 lines up with Daniel 7, 6, and verse 12. The first part of 13:5 matches with Daniel 7, 8, and verse 25. 13:5, the last half of the verse, matches up with Daniel 7:25 and chapter 12, 7, and verses 11 through 12 of Daniel 12. 13:6 matches up with Daniel 7:25, chapter 8, 10 through 11, and chapter 11, verse 36. And the first part of Revelation 13:7 matches Daniel 7:21, and the last part of that verse matches chapter 7, verse 14. Something else that you should understand about this, and it matches some of what we've already looked at in Revelation chapter 12. One of the things that was believed by the Romans in terms of this new Nero was going to set up an alliance. Remember when I've taught the class before, I told you about a group of people that were feared by the Romans, the Parthians, and the river that separated the two kingdoms was the Euphrates. Remember in chapter 12, there was four angels that were to set in place to hold the river back, the river Euphrates. And at one point, they were told to release it. And what that represented was, the next thing you know, John is talking about this huge army that he sees. And that army, according to Roman history, is representing an alliance between Rome and the Parthians, whom they feared. But it wasn't going to be Rome at that time. It was going to be this future reincarnated ruler they called Nero, the new Nero, the Antichrist, basically. And that they would be a union between his army and that of the Parthians. The Roman belief was that if that happened, they were indestructible. They couldn't be defeated. Just keep that in the back of your mind. And so that's what Jewish Christians who were actually Roman Christians would have been familiar with. Most Romans believe that. So keep that in mind as to how they possibly might have interpreted what they hear here. So let's go on reading a little bit, and then we'll talk about some more of it. And then I'll ask questions. But we left off with verse 3. And I saw one of his heads, we talked about that, that had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. So what did that represent? A kingdom that had been destroyed was going to rise up again. Isn't that interesting? And I'm not saying that they're right or wrong, but I'm just saying those heads were told in Daniel represent kingdoms. That's why they're wearing crowns. One of them was wounded mortally, but it's healed and comes back to life, basically. And all the kingdoms marveled and followed the beast. Now, we're not going to take any of this absolutely literally, but think about if a kingdom against Christianity was to rise up with a leader who was able to perform miraculous signs, would you automatically think he was an antichrist, or would you think he was something else? Because in history, who has been able to perform miraculous signs? Jesus, the apostles, even some of the prophets that were sent from God were able to do some of these things. So there would be some confusion, I would think, and you could see why a lot of people would be sucked into following after them. This is a resurrection of something. So let's go on and read further. Verse 4. So they worshipped the dragon. See, remember, it was the dragon that gave this beast his power and authority and his throne. One of his heads was mortally wounded, but now had regained its power. People were marveling at that. And then in verse 12, so they worshiped the dragon and gave authority to the, who gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? See the blasphemy that they're saying there? He must be a deity because he's able to do this from the authority that he gave and the power that he gave this beast. Who's capable of doing these things? So they worshiped the giver of the authority, the dragon, and obviously worshiped the beast. They were following it. Now it goes on to say, you know, who is like it? Who has the power then to go against these miraculous signs? So here's what happened according to the vision. And he was given a mouth. This is the beast he's talking about, speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months, or in other words, 3.5 years. We understand that. Which, what does 3.5 years mean? A little while, right? We know it matches up with a lot of things that happened in the Bible, but I don't want to get us bogged down into that. But for 3.5 years, for a little while. And so you can read about that matches up with Daniel 7, 8, 11, 20, 25, and 11, 36. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So, what do you think John is talking about? What do you think John is talking about? Who is this beast given authority over? What does the language represent? To make war against them. Who is John talking about? What's this vision actually telling him? Go ahead.
First, on chapter 12, the dragon was the one that's giving this.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So then after that, it would be a Nero.
Right.
And the death blow of Nero.
Which isn't Nero, it's another
right,
one. Yeah.
Which is Domitian. Actually, Vespasian was his father.
Was
Titus.
The next one. And then
the
Titus.
General
and then
Nero.
Yeah.
And then Titus, who only ruled
Very short time. Yeah, very short time.
Domitian's brother is Titus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's believed that he also poisoned. But that was just a
You're problem. Right, right. But you see, what is happening there when you look at that history is. The persecution of who? Christians. Started with Nero, so that's the persecution of the church, and continued through his reign, through the next emperor, and then through Domitian's reign, and actually continued a little bit after Domitian. So, after Domitian was gone.
Which was actually the last
Right, and he was gone after AD 88. Actually, excuse me, he came to power in 88, and it was sometime after 96 that he was gone. So, because he was the one who actually incarcerated John, exiled him, and so the book was written on Patmos, and by that chronology, we believe AD 96. So, it's just kind of interesting that some of this lines up with that, but other than that, there's a greater message here than just Rome. You know, the Christians of the first century feared Rome, not because they were afraid of Rome, but they were afraid of their lives because of Rome. And all the way through Revelation, they're instructed to be faithful, to persevere. And what were they told in Revelation 2:10, the last part of it? Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. That is what he told the church at Smyrna. So it's important that we remember that. It's just interesting to me that some of the history that Rome had matches somewhat with some of this vision. What it is to tell the early Christians to be strong, to persevere, and don't give up the faith. No matter what happens. What's going to happen here is you have this beast with several heads, and each head is a kingdom. Each head is an empire. Some of them have already passed. We have this one that is gone and is healed and rises to power, whoever you believe that to be. And then there is some more. And like I said, starting with Nero, this idea among the early Christians of the Antichrist, that's the first time they put that label on someone. And you can see why they certainly would have thought Nero to be an Antichrist, because he waged a campaign against them, and many of the early Christians were martyred at the hands of his, where they were executed at his command, basically. So he, in that respect, was an Antichrist. But is there only one Antichrist? You know, we're looking at it from our time in history backwards. And if you have studied history and looked at people like Nostradamus and others who, quote unquote, made future predictions, you're aware that there's more than one Antichrist that's predicted. Even some of the early Christians wrote that Nero wasn't the only one. Remember, they bought into, some of them bought into this new Nero. But I wanted you to understand, if you ever come across this theory, and some of the modern theologians will present that argument in their writings, and it'll sound convincing, understand that it's based on a tradition that Nero, the original Nero, after he died, at some point in the future, was going to be resurrected and lead Rome and with another army and defeat all of those that opposed Rome, i.e. the church, basically, because they were the biggest group to oppose Roman authority, especially when the emperor said, you got to worship me. Christians only worship one individual, and that's God. You know, they don't worship the emperor. Any thoughts or comments? Like I said, a lot of this parallels the visions of Daniel. And there in Daniel, you have the benefit of an angel coming to Daniel and giving him an explanation of what he's seeing. John is going to get that same benefit, but not in these chapters. It'll be down in chapter 17, where an angel appears to him and he asks, what does this mean? And we're given, to a certain degree, an explanation of what it does mean. So let's go on and read just a little bit further. Now remember, this beast that's given this authority over mankind, whether you be Christian or non-Christian, is working miraculous things. And by doing so, he gets a lot of followers, you see. They don't just worship him, they worship the dragon the devil, Satan, because he was the one to give this beast that authority. He gave him his authority, his power, and his throne, and authority over the nations. Understand that authority over the nations is not only non-Christians, but it is Christians who are going to be persecuted as a result of this authority that was going to be given to him. It goes on to say that while he's speaking blasphemy, it says that in verse 6, then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Okay. So Christians worship God. By being a Christian, does that automatically mean that someone's not going to be given power over you? Power to put you to death based on your belief? No, it doesn't. Who ultimately, this might seem a bit controversial, but I want you to think about it. Who ultimately has power? How do I want to say this? Who is behind power given to certain empires? You can go all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar. Where did that authority ultimately come from? Yes.
God.
Absolutely.
You ordained these things to minister what God's purpose.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely. And I firmly believe that that's what this is all about.
In John 19:11, it says all the authority is given.
Right, right. Go ahead.
Okay, John 19:11 says, Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless that given you from above.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's really what I was getting at here. All authority, no matter which side you're on, good or evil, ultimately comes from God. God gave authority to the nations to punish his people when they needed to be punished. And it was, we're taught in the Old Testament, was for a purpose of convincing them of their wrongs and bringing them back to a worship of God, which they never completely did.
He used his nation to punish his people too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the New Testament, I think we have ample evidence to see that God does the same thing. His vehicle in Revelation, I believe, it, to a great extent, was Rome, at least on the early Christians. Does it have to stop with Rome? Because remember, Rome wasn't the only head on that beast represented with a crown on it. And in Daniel, there's nations that are yet to come. So all throughout history, God has used nations as a vehicle to chastise and punish his people when they deserve it, and as a vehicle to get them to turn from what they're doing and pay attention to what God wants you to do. In the Old Testament, it's equated like a parent, like a father. No father likes to punish their children. But they understand, unless they do, the direction the child is going to go. Out of control, and you're all parents, you understand that. God's the same way. He doesn't get any pleasure out of punishing his children, but if he can do that and get them to get back on the right track, then he does. And throughout history, he's used rogue nations to do that. But did he hold them responsible for what they did? Think of Assyria. Think of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon. Think of Persia. Ultimately, yeah, they punished for God, his people, but they were held accountable for what they did, because as the Assyrians, they went to extremes. The Babylonians went to extremes. Persians did, but not to the extent of the other two, but they too were held accountable for what they did. In other words, those nations were allowed to come to power, but they were brought to their knees. In Daniel's vision, those are nations that are pictured there in that statue. The angel tells him, when he sees this image of this beast, that there's some kingdoms that have passed and some will be coming to power in the future. Now, fast forward to the first century, whenever John is seeing that again, and he sees live heads that have crowns on them, a dead head who's healed and comes back in his power. And just understand, the beliefs of the Romans concerning their empire and how that might, and I say might, fit into what you see here. And I'm not going to say if you believe it, that's right, and if you don't, that's wrong. You can believe this however you want to, but these are things that would have influenced the first century Christians as they read this. But the big message that they'll get out of it is just exactly what Christ said in the second chapter, verse 10. You're going to suffer tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you a crown of life. And that's the message that permeates throughout this whole book. Don't let some of this stuff that is going to come about influence you to turn away from God. Use it to make you strong. If you are strong and you persevere, then he'll take care of you, and you'll be part of the group in the last judgment. You won't be part of the group that is raised up and separated from those that will be with God. You'll be part of the group, because personally, I'm not sure that time frame is going to happen in our lifetime. It might. Sometimes I look at what's going on out there and I think we're getting close. But even at the first century, they could see things that I'm sure they thought, well, remember what the apostle said? It's shortly to come, you know. Well, it's shortly by God's viewpoint of time intervals, not by human. Who knows when he'll be fed up and have enough? But the thing of it is we need to be prepared, because we don't know when that's going to come. Even Christ, the instrument of that judgment, does not know when it's going to be. That's what he told the apostles. He doesn't know. But he does tell them and everyone else that reads what he says is, be prepared. Remember the ten virgins. Be prepared. If you're prepared, you've got nothing to fear. If you're not, you might be sucked away with some of this that's going to happen in one form or another. You know, the world is a corrupt place, and don't let yourself get sucked into it. Any other thoughts or comments? It's soon going to be time for us to stop for tonight. To me, chapter 12, 13 through 17 is probably one of the most interesting portions of the book of Revelation, and it's obviously the most controversial, because there's modern viewpoints on it, there's traditional viewpoints on it. I've been influenced in my life by some of each one of those, but it's something that you have to study to really formulate an opinion. And in reality, does it matter? It probably doesn't matter if you get the one message out of it, and that is, be strong, persevere, be faithful unto death, and you've got nothing to worry about. Yes, go ahead. Right, exactly. Yeah, we've all remember the story of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and how they were thrown into a fiery furnace that was made seven times hotter than what was normal to, as a kiln, to cure bricks. And that's hot by itself. But seven times that, remember, they couldn't even approach that furnace without fear. And so they were thrown into them, and what happened to the guards that threw them in? They were burned also. But what was the outcome for Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego? They remained faithful, as Elmore said, right up to the point of death. And what was the comment of the king whenever they were brought out? You don't even smell like smoke. Not only were they not burnt, the clothes that they were wearing wasn't burnt, the whatever it was they were wrapped in wasn't burnt, and the ropes they were tied with wasn't burnt, and when all of that was removed, you don't even smell like smoke. What do you think that king thought when he witnessed that? There's a power here greater than me. And remember, it all started when he said, he erected that image and said, you need to worship me. And they didn't. They refused. So that's the message we should carry away from these chapters, is that God keeps his promises. And if we keep ours to him, we've got nothing to worry about. Okay, it's time to finish tonight. So I'm going to tell Aaron that we were doing some preliminary discussion of this. We got down to verse 7. And he may want to rediscuss some of this from his own viewpoint. But most everybody here this evening, we'll wait a few minutes for the other classes to come in. And then we'll have our invitation.